So it's all here. The story of our time with the bar call.
That was President Lyndon Baines Johnson upon the dedication of his presidential library in 1971. Since then, the library has played host to the biggest names and best minds of our day, who have helped to tell the story of our times through candid, revealing conversations with the Barkoff. This podcast delivers them straight to you. Welcome to With the Barkoff. I'm Mark Updegrove. Clay Risen is the senior politics editor at the New York Times. His latest book, The Crowded Hour, Theodore Roosevelt, The Rough Riders and the Dawn of the American Century, charts Theodore Roosevelt's meteoric rise in American life as he organizes a legendary volunteer army to fight the Spanish-American War in Cuba. Clay Risen, welcome to With the Barkoff. We're delighted to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, your book is called The Crowded Hour, Theodore Roosevelt, The Rough Riders, and the Dawn of the American Century. But let's start with the first of those things, Theodore Roosevelt. Who was Theodore Roosevelt at the turn of last century?
So when I pick up his story with the book, he's actually a guy who is not really sure where he is going with his life. He wrote to a friend a few years before 1898, when the action takes place, that he was worried that history was going to pass him by. You know, he's somebody who had great aspirations to be a world leader, but he worried that, you know, here he was kind of bouncing around between Washington and New York, these, you know, different respectable jobs, doing good stuff, but not really climbing in the way he wanted to. And then over the course of 1898, you know, he goes from being the assistant secretary of the Navy, quitting, to become, an officer in this experimental regiment of volunteer cavalry, goes off to Cuba, comes back a war hero, and is governor of New York by the time he ends out the year. And that really is where the next chapter in his story begins, and that he goes to the vice presidency and then the presidency. So this is really a hinge point in his life.
He's 38 years old and is about to begin this meteoric rise. But what makes Theodore Roosevelt tick? Why does he want to make his mark on the world?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. You know, first of all, he comes out of a tradition in his family and out of a New York tradition that, you know, is very rooted in the kind of noblesse oblige, doing good for the, doing good for your society. But unlike a lot of people in that world, he aimed for politics. A lot of them disdained politics. But he saw politics as a place where he could and should make his mark. And, you know, I think part of that is because he has had this very pragmatic sensibility. He was not someone who was happy just dispersing funds or sitting on boards. You know, he was somebody who wanted to get in and wrangle and defeat his political enemies and see the impact of his good work in the world around him. And the other thing is that he was somebody who, from a very early age, really saw it as his obligation almost to himself to prove himself, to make himself. You know, he was not a healthy child. He was asthmatic. He had bad eyesight. And he really built himself physically into someone who was pretty imposing. And I think he had that same idea about his career. He had to purposefully build his career. He couldn't just kind of let life take him where it went.
And part of that is getting involved in raising a volunteer army. So how does that come about?
Yeah, well, so, you know, one of the things that I always found fascinating about this story, and people do when I tell them, is that, you know, when the United States declared war on Spain and was getting ready to invade Cuba, it had a big problem, which was there was no army. The United States had, by law, a limit on how large an army it could have, 26,000 soldiers and 2,000 officers. And most of them were spread around the country. They'd never practiced for war. They'd only practiced for coastal defense and stuff like that. So getting ready to go fight, they had to come up with a way to get a lot of battle-ready soldiers quickly. And it would take a long time to train the militias and volunteers who were out there. So Roosevelt had this idea of, well, what if we took people who are kind of halfway there already? People who are, you know, cowboys and ex-military, veterans, police officers, miners, people who are used to kind of the rough side of life, as well as college athletes and people that he knew personally, who had just kind of that love of kind of the rough and tumble. Why don't you take them, give them enough training, and send them, and they would be a kind of bridge. You know, and they would add to the existing force, and then they would be enough to wait until these the volunteers were trained.
I'm going to get back to this eclectic cast of characters called the Rough Riders in a moment, but why does the United States of America need volunteers to fight a war in 1898?
Well, that's exactly it, is that we had this idea about the way that the American military should work in the 19th century, and it was very different from what we have today. And back then, it was this kind of voluntaristic idea. We didn't see ourselves as a militaristic country, maybe a violent country, maybe an expansionary country, but not militarist, not in the way that Europe was, right? So France had 500,000 soldiers under arms at any one time. Germany, Britain had one of the smaller ones and was still multiples larger than the US. And so, but the idea was always, we can rely on our volunteers. We did it in the Revolutionary War. We did it in the Mexican-American War. We did it in the Civil War. We'll do it again. And we'll have these volunteers who will sort of rise up. And they did. 1 million men volunteered to fight in the Spanish-American War. Most of them never saw combat. But the flip side is that a lot of men died in the Civil War because they were not well trained. And a lot of men died in the Mexican-American War because they were thrown into combat without real understanding of how to fight. And so enough people like Roosevelt saw that as a real problem, and a real problem going forward, because it would be one thing to fight the Spanish and we'd probably win. But what about the next time? What if, you know, Roosevelt foresaw World War I. He saw a day when the United States and Germany would fight. He even foresaw World War II when the United States and Japan would fight. And he was thinking about those things and saying, you know, we can't fight those countries with green volunteers. We're going to be destroyed.
Why was he so prescient, Clay? Why did he see this when others did not?
So Roosevelt always had a really strategic mind. It's one of the reasons why early on he was much more attracted to the Navy than to the Army, because there was a lot of work. He loved the history and the lore of the Navy. He wasn't much of a sailor himself, and in fact, he didn't particularly like going on ships. But he loved the life of the Navy. But he also loved the way that the Navy was almost by definition a strategic tool. That it was a force that projected power. And all through the 19th century, he saw that both in experiences that the United States had, but also globally. And it's something that he wrote on constantly. And it's where the Navy was the place where during the kind of, let's say, the Gilded Age, era, the late 19th century, all the great strategic military thinking was going on at the Navy. And so Roosevelt was in touch with these people. He was talking to them. And so much of the conversation was around, as the United States grows, what are the conflict points? Where is the United States going to fight? And the feeling was, for a variety of reasons, we're not going to fight with the British. There will be tensions. We won't fight with the French, but it's the Germans. And the reason Roosevelt's thinking was that both the United States and Germany were late to the expansion game. France and Britain, Italy, Portugal, Spain, they already had their territories, their colonies. Germany was getting out late in the game and was very active, was trying to gobble up territory wherever it could, and just as the United States was coming in. So Roosevelt very cleverly saw the possibility of a war with Germany. He wasn't specific, it'll happen in Europe versus it'll happen in, you know, the South Pacific, but he definitely saw that conflict.
You write that at the turn of last century, America was not just a country, but an idea. And you further write that the Rough Riders promised that American power would always promote not just America's interests, but its values. What do you mean by that?
So one of the debates about American foreign policy in the 19th century went between, there were really two ideals. One was the idea that America was fundamentally not isolationist, but was inward looking, was protected naturally from enemies. We were lucky to have Mexico to the south, Canada to the north, and big oceans. And so, you know, the tensions that we were going to have were not going to be of the kind of the global power type. And so we could afford not to entangle ourselves in global conflicts and of the type that that enveloped Europe in, you know, various points in the 19th century and certainly before that. And so, you know, a lot of people felt that's good, that let's stay that way. And that synced up very nicely with other ideas about what America was. It was a country of small government. It was a country of small landholders who basically got, you know, could do whatever they wanted. It wasn't a regimented place. It wasn't the sort of place that could organize an active foreign policy. But by the end of the 19th century, there was a different idea. You know, people called them jingoists. People called them, you know, colonialists. You know, there were different attitudes, but and different perspectives on this movement. But the what was at the base of it was this idea that America can no longer afford to be isolated, and that one way or the other, we will go out in the world. We can't avoid it, and so we have to talk about that. We have to talk about what it means. And one of the things that people like Roosevelt and others were trying to really trying to elucidate and outline in the late 1890s was to say, well, there's a way to do both. There's a way to go abroad and be kind of the lamp of freedom, the you know, sort of derided as the world's policeman. But, you know, we can go abroad and bring democracy and freedom, and that's how we will expand. We won't do it as a colonizer. We'll do it as a liberator. And, you know, again, we can look back on that today and say, well, you know, it's not that easy. We can cast aspersions on that. But at the time, it was a very powerful idea. And and I think the war, the Spanish-American War, really brought that resolution to the minds of many Americans, that idea that we can be a global power in our own way.
The Rough Riders took on a life of their own in a way after the famous charge up San Juan Hill and the stories of battle that were coming from Cuba back to the United States. But you talked a little bit about the Rough Riders generally, Clay. Who were they specifically? And talk about some of the more famous Rough Riders, this eclectic cast of interesting characters.
Yeah, so pretty much from the beginning, the Rough Riders were the story of the war, of the Spanish-American War. They were about 1,000 men drawn from all walks of life. You had cowboys, you had miners, but you also had some of the sons of some of the wealthiest families in America and some of the most politically powerful families in America, the Fish family, which was and you know, still is to some extent a powerful New York political family. They Hamilton Fish, who was one of the young scions of that family, he was a Rough Rider. The number one, the number two tennis players in the country quit tennis to become Rough Riders, and actually then went back and won multiple U.S. Opens, each of them. But there were a lot of Rough Riders who had not been famous beforehand, but they were made famous by the journalists who followed the newspaper. And of course, Roosevelt himself, it was pretty well known before this. So the fact that he was there leading this group really shined a light on all of them. And, you know, they gathered in San Antonio for about 4 weeks of training, really pretty minimal training, but a lot of them already had pretty good skills with a horse, pretty good skills with a rifle. Basically, they just needed training and kind of military formation. And then they were off, and they went off to Cuba. And along the way, these journalists followed them. They knew what a good story was, and more of them came on board. And Roosevelt was very good at cultivating the right journalists and cultivating the right mix of journalists, both people who would dash off reports really quickly and then others who were going to write longer form magazine pieces that would appear in magazines that at the time were getting, you know, 4 or 5 million subscribers. And so, you know, within a month or two, anyone who hadn't heard this, hadn't been following the story of the Rough Riders, knew the story of the Rough Riders because of these lengthy dispatches that were all extremely positive.
Why do these wealthy people want to fight in a war? I mean, you had the Civil War, where you had wealthy folks paying people to take their place in the war. Why do they want to fight a war?
Yeah, I think part of it is generational, in that you have these people who went off to war in the Civil War, and you're right, a lot of wealthy people paid to have someone else go for them, but a lot of wealthy people did go off to the war, and a lot of people made money off of being war heroes. A lot of political leaders in the post-Civil War era got their start. In fact, Roosevelt was the first president since Grant who had not served in the Civil War. Every single one of them, and most of them had gotten their start, their political start, by leading a famous unit or winning some sort of award that they then turned into politics. But others did it with business. And then, of course, there's the glory of the Civil War, which is just really sort of led people to forget all the horrors of what happened in the Civil War. It's this glorious conflict. And so you get a generation of young men coming up in what at the time was real, great creature comfort. I mean, all the great technologies were coming, cars and electricity and indoor plumbing and all these things that made them feel very, very comfortable with their lives. And they felt the desire to go prove themselves somehow. And then the other thing about this that gets forgotten is that the war had this very intense moral component. It's comparable to the way that some people talked about the Iraq War before going into it. There was this, not so much with the weapons of mass destruction side, but with the Saddam Hussein is a tyrant and a genocidal maniac, and we need to free the Iraqis. People had that same idea about the Cuban people, that the Spanish were committing genocide in Cuba, and that it was the obligation of the United States as a neighbor, as a powerful country, to go free them. And so you had a lot of people who are saying, this is our moral obligation as Americans. Mm. We have to go free the Cubans in the same way that, say, the French came to help us in the revolution. There was a strong religious component. A lot of religious leaders saw this as an obligation. So you have young men who really found it irresistible, this call to war.
This moral quest, as it were.
Absolutely.
So talk about that famous charge up San Juan Hill, which has become so iconic in military history. What was that like?
So it's a fascinating situation because it very easily could have been a disaster. And in fact, in a lot of ways, everything but the charge and what came from it was a disaster. There was, just to lay the scene for you, there were sort of two hills. There was a ridge line that the Spanish were occupying, and on the other side was Santiago, the city that the Americans were trying to capture. The Spanish were dug in with trenches and guard posts and very well defended. And so the American strategy, there really was no strategy. There was no plan. It was essentially to send, better part of 15,000 men down this narrow path, spread out along the riverbank, and then charge or something. But the orders were not very well explained. And so that's what they did. And pretty quickly, all these men found themselves in triple-digit heat, under fire from the Spanish, just nowhere to go back, nowhere to go forward. And so Roosevelt was one of the officers. He was a colonel at that point in charge of his regiment. Now, others quickly realized this as well, that the only answer, the only way out was this suicidal charge up the hill, that everything else would be complete destruction. So let's charge up the hill. It's the one thing the Spanish don't expect, and maybe we'll get enough guys up to the top. And so that's what Roosevelt did. And he was one of the few people on a horse. Most of the men had to leave their horses in Florida. And so he was on a horse. He, shouted charge. He started rushing forward. And at first, most of the men around him did not follow. Some of them did. But then when others saw those guys charging, it sort of dawned on them that this was happening. And so more and more started going. And eventually Roosevelt, they got some barbed wire and he got off of his horse, but they kept running and they kept falling because they were being shot by the Spanish. But there were enough Americans, and then other regiments followed as well. So they got to the top of the hill and kind of regrouped and then ran across this kind of saddle indentation. There was a couple of hundred yards. And that was where, and ultimately to San Juan Hill, atop which was a big Spanish fort. And by coming at it kind of at the side, they were able to take advantage of its weak spot. And very quickly, you know, by the time Roosevelt got there, other regiments were charging directly up San Juan Hill. And the battle was over pretty quickly after that.
And in your book, Clay, Theodore Roosevelt is courageous. He's undaunted by all that's going on around him somehow. Where does he find that calm?
That's a good question. It's something that I think was always in him. You know, he was someone who people would talk about how excitable he was and how full of energy he was, but he wasn't nervous. It was never nervous energy. You know, he was never somebody who lost his cool. He would get angry in a righteous way, but he didn't lose his temper in a way that other people might. And I think that's a version of what you saw on that day in Cuba, was that he was very cool under fire. And he was someone who had also a kind of, I don't want to say like a grandiose vision of himself, but he definitely had a personal narrative in which this kind of thing fit. You know, he was someone who had risked his life in a lot of ways already, whether it was hunting or mountain climbing or, you know, any number of adventures. And so for him, I think this, not to demean what he did at all, it was the most courageous thing he did in his whole life. But it also, I think, fit in a pattern that to him was just the next thing, that the next challenge, the next hill to climb, so to speak.
But as you say, you know, this is somebody who's trying to make himself. He is nothing if not self-made. And that means throwing himself into different tasks, into different challenges. And there's no better way to test a man's courage than in battle. But he seems intoxicated by the romance of battle. Is Theodore Roosevelt a jingoist?
Yeah, no, for sure he was. He called himself that. It was something that I don't want to say he embraced as an honor, but it was a term that he understood differently. You know, he saw the criticism of the jingoes coming from a place that he just didn't need to respect. The idea that America should never engage with the world. I mean, he may have had a very caricatured vision of that, but you know, for him, his enemies were so completely wrong that he didn't really care what they called him. And he basically said, look, if you call my vision for American power jingoism, that's fine. That's jingoism. You know, and then he would go on to explain, look, my vision of American power is one where, you know, we're out there as a force for good. We're out there expanding our values and our interests and doing it in a calculated, rational way that brings peace. But the only way to do that is to be aggressive and to have a strong military. And so, you know, I think, you know, he was never someone who apologized for his views. You know, he was someone who admitted when he was wrong, but he was never someone who said, who tried to prune back his position if other people thought it was controversial.
So for Theodore Roosevelt, it's not just about fighting. It's about fighting for what's right. It's about these moral crusades.
Yeah, of course. And I think this is also where the Spanish-American War is so formative in his experience. Before, and certainly in the early 1890s, you can find some of his writing that I think even he would admit was pretty embarrassing. And it's kind of bloodlust, you know, this desire both personally for combat and for the kind of martial experience, but also in a national way, to the idea that, you know, he firmly believed that all American men, all men should have to go through some sort of trial by fire in order to be considered real men. And that there was a value in combat and as an end in itself. I think the experience that he had in the Spanish-American War tempered that. It didn't temper it completely, and he was one who greatly supported American entrance into World War I, for example. But he was also, I think, that experience and seeing his soldiers die, seeing the Spanish die, seeing what happened to the Cuban civilians. All of these things gave him a firsthand view of the sorrows of war. And I think so much of what he did as president was designed to help prevent America from ever having to go into that situation. Now, if we chose to go into that situation, that was a different thing. But for Roosevelt, the important thing was to be so well prepared that we were never caught in a position where violence and war was the only answer.
Does the experience change him in other ways, Clay? That experience of forming this regiment and going into battle?
Yeah, I think it really made him a leader in the sense that, you know, we think of Theodore Roosevelt as president as being a great leader. And he was. And he was someone who knew how to speak to a crowd and win over a crowd. He was someone who knew how to develop loyalty, political loyalty. He was someone who knew how to delegate. And this was not, I think part of that was innate in him, but it was also not something he had a lot of experience with up until the war. You know, he had been all over the place in his career. He had never really run an operation. You know, he had a ranch and he was sort of a, you know, businessman. On the other hand, the ranch failed. And, you know, he was very much a kind of rare bird. He was a writer. He was a political maverick. And so he gets to the experience of the Spanish-American War, where he's in charge, not just of leading men, but of he's responsible for their lives and for making these fatal decisions and very difficult decisions. And I think that crucible really brought together a lot of these, you know, different base metals in his character that created an alloy of leadership that then he took with him into office. I mean, you know, I don't want to say he would never have been president had it not been for the Spanish-American War, but I think that he would have been a very different president. I think he would not have had perspective and really the leadership temperament that he did had he not gone through that experience.
T.R. is one of four presidents on Mount Rushmore, the others being Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, and Thomas Jefferson. C-SPAN's recent 2021 Presidential Historians poll out yesterday has him ranked as our fourth greatest president. What makes Theodore Roosevelt so great?
So I think there are two things, right? One is what makes him great and what makes us think he's great.
Right. Fair enough.
And so I think, you know, objectively, look, it's easy to count his achievements. You know, he was responsible for the Panama Canal. He was responsible for really creating a whole paradigm of government control or regulation over business. He brought an end to the kind of Gilded Age and introduced really a much more 20th century approach to the way that capitalism should function. He laid the groundwork for all kinds of things in terms of social welfare, in terms of the environment, creating conservation as a core obligation of the government, of governments at all levels. He brought peace to East Asia in the end of the Russo-Japanese War and won the Nobel Prize for it. And he did all this at a very young age. He was still in his 40s. And as an accidental president, I mean, maybe he probably would have been president at any time, but the whole idea of him being vice president was to kind of get him out of the governor's office in New York. You know, it's and all of a sudden there he is as president. And so I think objectively, it's hard to argue with those as you know, real signal achievements of a great president. Why we think he's a great president has a lot to do with those things, of course, but it also has to do with the way that he occupied that office, the way that he redefined what it meant to be president, and the way that even 120 years ago, that resonates. You know, we look at him and he is a great orator. He's a great persuader of men. He is a great political, you know, political figure in all those ways. And he does it in a way that's not partisan by our terms today. or even by his terms at the time. You know, he was a Republican who was embraced big government when it was necessary. He was a pragmatist. He was someone who was able to both be his own person and also root it so deeply in these kind of timeless American values, and to grapple with timeless American questions and timeless American problems. And so we can both see him as someone who is a man of his time, a man of all times, certainly someone who today, I mean, I get asked this question all the time. What would Theodore Roosevelt do if he were president today? And, you know, it's kind of a funny question, but it's also, if you had to pick any president, he's a good one to kind of play around with, because you can imagine Theodore Roosevelt today. And, you know, and yet he's someone who, you know, was so much thinking about his time and thinking about his place. And so just subjectively, he's a very attractive figure. He's someone who, you know, really wore himself on his sleeves. He was not especially self-reflective. You know, he was not someone who admitted his errors, and that is often where we find his flaws. You know, some of his racial views, some of his views on, especially his views on women, are complicated, but also complicated in a way that can seem pretty progressive today. He supported women's right to vote. He was, he desegregated the White House by having dinner with Booker T. Washington. And so there are complications and that make it hard to pin him as the bad guy. And that also makes him very human and very modern in that way.
You are not only an author, but the senior political editor at the New York Times. And I want to ask you the questions that you get asked all the time, naturally. How would Theodore Roosevelt see our political environment today? Would he recognize it based on what he saw in his lifetime?
Yeah, so one of the things that I think, I mean, this is sort of a parlor trick, but is, I think there's something to it, that, you know, the late 1890s, let's say early 1900s, the aughts of their time, are very, very similar to today in the broad scheme of things. You have the question of where is America in the world? Very much a question today, very much a question then. Technology was rewriting American society. At that time, it was cars, electricity, the telephone. Railroads had already knitted the country together. Today, it's obviously the internet and yada yada, but deeply resonant and deeply revolutionary changes. You had real struggles with the place of the relationship between capitalism and society and government. What is the relationship between these new businesses? At the time, it was the trusts. It was the oil trust and railroad trusts. Today, it's these enormous technology companies. A lot of the arguments are the same, that the government has no role in regulating them. Roosevelt, of course, found ways to answer those questions. And immigration was also a huge issue at the time. Immigration was rewriting the face of the American population, the same way it is today. And so I think Roosevelt, in that sense, would find things very, very familiar. He was also a historian. I think he would very quickly understand that while today is very different, also all things are extensions of wherever you are at the moment. So he would look and say, yes, well, I can see why this and that is the way it is today, because this is what it was like when I was alive. What would he think about it? I mean, look, I think one of the reasons why he's so appealing is that he would be someone who tried to thread the needle between left and right. And not because not because he's a compromiser or because he's someone who, tries to see both sides. He's someone who naturally occupies that territory. It's where he was in the 19th, when he was in office. You know, he was someone who embraced a lot of the ideas that the Democrats and populists were putting forward, even as he had no quarter for radicals or socialists or, you know, people that at the time, just like today, were an important part of the political conversation. At the same time, he thought that the Republican Party, as he knew it, was in crisis, and it was. And he was trying to elucidate a new path forward for the Republican Party, and I think he would be doing that today. I mean, look, there's it's not incidental that both Josh Hawley and Tom Cotton on the right and Elizabeth Warren, all three of them adore Theodore Roosevelt for totally different reasons. But all three of them see him as this iconic figure. And I think that that speaks to kind of the position that he would occupy today.
The book is The Crowded Hour, Theodore Roosevelt, The Rough Riders, and the Dawn of the American Century. And my guest is the New York Times, Clay Rising. Clay, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Mark. It was a pleasure.
My thanks to our sponsors, the Moody Foundation and St. David's Healthcare, and as always, to you for joining us. If you've enjoyed this episode, subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Mark Updegrove. See you next time.